I had a hard time figuring out what exactly I should be speaking about today, more mathematics or more philosophy, or so this will be a combination of different things. But let me start, before I go to my slides, let me start by saying a few words about Lucian's remarks that he made as opening remarks for this conference. And those things I'm going to say can be found mostly in my work, in my BJPS article on reconstruction of quantum theory. There is another article in PS, and this article is a more technical article about some mathematical results. So this is a general overview article of the different attempts of reconstruction. So remember Lucian said we start with this mathematical framework, and then what we believe quantum theory to be, and also the axioms. Right, I think it actually slightly differs, at least in my point of view, it slightly differs from that. I would argue that we really start with the principles. We start with the principles, which can be formulated in a general way, not necessarily in the mathematical language of a given framework. So reconstruction is first of all about the principles, and then these principles can be translated, can be mathematically formulated in different frameworks. So the same principles, let's say the ones I'm going to talk about today, can be represented as axioms in, let's say, C-star framework, remember these things, or convex set framework, or quantum logical framework, or other frameworks. So the principles come first, and then the mathematical representation of principles, call them axioms, comes second, and then we derive the framework from there. And also the question is, what exactly do we derive? But this one I'm going to talk about in the presentation. So here is the topic of my talk. I'm going to focus on a particular kind of reconstructions from information theoretic axioms, or axioms about information. The questions you have right now, what is information, what is physics, if we look at it from the point of view of information, I'm going to deal with a bit later. So quantum theory in the information theoretic frameworks is seen as a general theory of information constrained by these principles. So remember, we start with the principles. And then it can be reconstructed from an information theoretic axiomatic system. So the second stage involves a mathematical framework. It involves a representation of these general principles as concrete mathematical statements in a concrete language. So historical context, this is a long introduction I'm going to make. Historical context, these are just some of the papers that most of you know about. There are plenty of others on information theoretic reconstructions. It started with some ideas which are not just Wheeler, but also Bill Wooters in the late 70s and early 80s. And then a whole bunch of papers appeared over time with very different mathematical frameworks every time. So some of these are, let's say, quantum information, quantum computational language. Some of these are C-star algebra. Some of these are quantum logic or probabilistic frameworks. So a whole bunch of different things talking about information. Now, these are very different from things we have seen historically, and here's an example that Lucian has already mentioned. This is what, in the 50s, we had as an idea of reconstruction, if you like. So in the 50s, people like Mackey, and then, of course, Ludwig a bit later, and other people, people like Mackey had all these long lists of mathematical axioms. The axioms whose meaning is not directly clear when you read these things. So these are some mathematical statements. And this, to me, is not what reconstruction is. Reconstruction, instead of starting from a list of opaque, of not directly comprehensible mathematical statements. For, you know, you have to actually think about what the meaning of these things is. Reconstructions start, and this is a quote from Rovelli, reconstructions for me start from, if you like, simple, quote unquote, simple assertions, certain principles which we believe to be fundamental about quantum theory. Now, where do these come from? As Lucien said, usually these come from the practice of quantum theory, so we believe that that or this thing which is true about quantum theory is so fundamental that we want to elevate it to the status of a principle. So what I call reconstruction is fundamentally different from these things. It starts with a set of physical principles, with a set of fundamental assertions or postulates, and then translates them into a mathematical formalism from which we can derive things. So the rest of this talk is supposed to be some philosophy, then some mathematics, and then some open problems. I would really like to focus on the open problems, though, and give you in this talk a list of things we can reconstruct and a list of problems that more or less all of these reconstructions have to deal with. So the purpose of the talk will be an overview of the open problems rather than doing a lot of philosophy. So that's why for now I'm going to skip the first part. And this is a part about what do we mean by information, what do we mean by physics, is information physical, and things like this. So if you want to hear more about that, let's go back to this first part in the question period. But I guess many of you have already heard me speak about that. So if those questions remain, we'll talk about that later. So let me skip a few slides. Okay, let's talk about quantum logical reconstructions. So a particular reconstruction I'm going to talk about is due to Rovelli, but before we go into the details of that, before we look at the axioms as the physical principles, let me start by saying, exactly as Chaslov did, that there are certain fundamental notions of which the most problematic here is going to be the notion of a system, which is a primitive notion in all of the quantum logical derivations. So a system is something which is there, which is not defined, not derived, not reconstructed, and that's something we have to think about. And a lot of people are actually thinking about what we mean on the system and what this involves already, just the very fact that we talk about systems. What this leads to already for the reconstruction program. So there are systems in the quantum logical framework, according to a very classical orthodox view, the way which was probably, you know, the best example of which is the, as I call it, the Bible of the of quantum logic, the book by Beltrametti and Castanelli in 82. Information is going to be represented as answers, as yes-no questions. So some of the questions are going to be asked and answers are going to be obtained to yes-no, to the binary question. So these are the fundamental notions of the quantum logical framework. And again, whichever framework we adopt, the notion of system in C-star algebras, so the notion of algebra, in the quantum logic, the notion of system to which we ask questions, this is a fundamental notion which also must be thought about. You know, where do these things come from? Okay, so here are Rovelli's axioms. These are the axioms Carlo Rovelli proposed in his 1996 paper called Relational Quantum Mechanics, where he argued for an interpretation, not a reconstruction, an interpretation of quantum mechanics, which he calls relational interpretation. And he suggested that actually quantum mechanics, being for him a theory about information, that quantum mechanics could be derived, which he didn't do himself, from information theoretic axioms. So he proposed these two axioms. And the question is, how much can you actually derive from these axioms? So this is some work, as Lucien said, I have done something like 5 years ago. I'm going to spend some time talking about this quantum logical derivation, which I call here the old strategy, which is really the use of axiom one. And we're not going to read the axioms and see exactly what these axioms give to us. So I'm going to use the axiom one for now to derive things. The axioms are the following. Axiom one, there is a maximum amount of relevant information that can be extracted from a system. Axiom two, one can always obtain new information about a system. These two seem to contradict each other directly if it were not for this word relevant. So the second one doesn't have the word relevant before information, and the first one does have the word relevant before information. So we're going to look at this interplay of something which is bounded, and on the other hand, we can always obtain new information, so that means that some old information becomes irrelevant and sort of forgotten. And this is what these two axioms are going to generate. The framework, in the quantum logical framework, we're going to play with relevance to derive certain structures. So this is the old strategy. The old strategy consists to use axiom one, to use the maximum amount of relevant information to derive lattice orthomodularity. So here I'm in the framework of orthodox quantum logic, and I'm talking about lattices, right? Let me actually be specific about the assumptions and about what I have to derive. Here is a long list of things that form quantum mechanics, at least in its mechanical version, right? Finite dimensional, no field theory, nothing like that. We first have to go to the Hilbert space. This is actually a very partial list. Well, we'll see what else we need. So we have to go to the Hilbert space from some fundamental structure which we're going to postulate. And then we need to add things to this Hilbert space. So this Hilbert space is going to be a Hilbert space of operators. We start with an assumption that there is a lattice of yes-no questions, as I said. This assumption is an expensive assumption in the sense that there's nothing operational and nothing information theoretic that tells us why any two elements, A and B in the lattice, are such that there is a join in the meet, are such that there is that these two things, can you see this? Actually, green is maybe not the best color. There's nothing in the information theoretic language that we can say about why these two things are defined, why join and meet in the lattice are defined for any two elements. So this is an assumption which is, which produced in the 80s the decline of orthodox quantum logic. And people went to more general structures, you know, post-sets, then maybe fact algebras, et cetera, et cetera. So this is one of the things which was given up at some point. But let's still, for the purposes of this talk, let's talk about the framework of orthodox quantum logic with lattices. So those lattices, yes? Yeah, I know, but arbitrary meets.
They have an operational case, they define. It's an operational, you can agree or not, but there is no operational.
Okay, no, right, okay. Okay, I agree. I mean, Piron believes he could have done it, but I don't think. I mean, there is a debate in one of Mittelstadt's books about how reasonable these things are. So
we only want to think about finite connections, and then it doesn't work. The moment you allow yourself to use the infinite connection, which was taboo for the more logic inspired people like Mittelstadt, then you can actually easily do it. So you have to subject yourself to
to sigma, yeah, to sigma structures.
Sigma.
Even infinite, yeah, even uncountable, even uncountable, yeah. Yeah, so, there is a debate. I'll talk about this axiom in the open question. So maybe there is more to be said about this lattice thing. So the lattice is still about this first preliminary stage. The second preliminary stage is that there is orthogonal complementation on the lattice. This can be motivated operationally in many ways. You know, you can say that there is a question such that you get an answer no for only in those cases, and only in those cases when to some other question you get an answer yes. So there is a bunch of operational justifications of orthogonality, which I'm again not looking into. I'm starting here with an assumption that I have an ortho-complemented lattice. I'm going to talk about the definition of relevance and show you that proof of orthomodularity. And then I'm going to actually look at the open problems, at what else you have to add to this structure. Okay, so here's something about relevance. This is a piece of work that you can find in that paper in FondPhysLet, in Foundations of Physics Letters. Relevance is going to be defined mathematically before we go in the lattice. Some quantum logical definition of relevance. Before we give this definition, let me motivate this definition from sort of intuitive or, if you want, everyday considerations. So this is a purely intuitive talk when I'm not defining terms. Consider a question such that this question entails a negation of another question. Just some question. Okay. So then if we ask this other question A here, what intuitively does it mean to ask a question B after that? If we ask an A and we obtain an answer to A, yes or no, if we are genuinely interested in B, so it means that if we're asking B, B can be either yes or no. If we're sort of asking a genuine new question B, that means that the observer really expects an answer, doesn't know the answer. So this is a sort of intuitive argument for what is going to follow mathematically. So this in turn is possible only when at the moment you ask B, the information obtained from A has become irrelevant. Because otherwise there's really no way you can expect genuinely a yes or a no answer to B. So I'm going to use this idea that if you ask a B question after an A question such that there is something similar to this situation. Of course, we have to, you know, there is no implication easily definable in quantum logic. So we have to replace this thing by something else. But if there is something that resembles this construction, then we're going to say that asking B renders A irrelevant. Yeah. Well, you'll see just in a second why I want to keep this negation sign here. Yeah, just in a second you'll see why I want that. Yeah. Oh, that's if B, then.
Right, but then it's only if you get a yes to A. But we don't have any implication about B.
Yeah, I mean, this assumes that's why if you want... imagine you ask A, obtain yes to A. Yeah, that's the same, right? Obtain. Okay, then here's false, right? Then if you want to... Okay.
So that second line doesn't really make it clear that you get yes.
Yeah, I should probably write here. If you ask A and obtain, so imagine, like swap these two lines. Yeah, I imagine. Okay. So my definition in terms of quantum logic is going to be this, sort of using this intuition that we have just talked about, I'm going to say that B is irrelevant with respect to A. So here's some B, here's some A somewhere in the lattice. Right? These do not have to be directly following each other in the lattice. So this can be far away in the lattice. B is irrelevant with respect to A if B, between B and the ortho complement of A, there is a non-zero join. There is a non-zero mean. So if there is some question which is inferior both to B and to the complement of A, and this question isn't zero, then by asking B after A, we render A irrelevant. So this is my quantum logical translation of this implication sign that you have just seen. Oh, there's a sequence, yes. The way it works is that there is an index time. There is T1, T2. So you ask questions one after another. This is, There is no sequence on the graph. No, on the graph itself has no sequence. So it's the definition. So this is a pure definition. I call B irrelevant with respect to A if this and that. So here is no time. What I said to explain it, there is no time here. What I said to explain this graph looks like a sequential explanation, but in the definition itself, there is no sequence.
Yeah, my problem is I'm not getting any information about that graph. I don't know what is it.
You have a lattice. You have a lattice. In the lattice, you have mates and joins.
Yeah, but what does that mean? It means it's a low inclination, a low vertex, or a higher vertex, in a different position. Having that point, it's zero as far as I think it's
So this is a partial order in the lattice, if you want. Yeah, the lines are partial. The way you depict a lattice is here. It means that right.
Okay.
Yeah, when it goes up, it means that this is less or equal to. Okay, this is a partial order. Oh, the motivation is from, you sort of look at it from a distance. The motivation is, I'm sitting here, I'm an observer. I have all these questions that I can ask, and I pick my questions and ask them. Yeah, that's how you think about it. No. There is no probability so far. I don't want to have any probabilities here. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, if you want to speak about it conditionally, you can say if I ask B, then whatever information was there at A obtained at A. I haven't thought about conditional interpretations really, but one thing I clearly don't want here is to talk about probabilities, because for me they come in at a later stage. So here is just a very pure situation when I have my set of questions, that's all, with ortho complementation in it. So there are no states, no probabilities, nothing. Right, so this notion is trivial in Hilbert lattices. Hilbert lattices are the lattices of closed subspaces of a Hilbert space. This notion is trivial because it is true that X, which all such X that are less or equal to some given Y are relevant with respect to Y, and all others are irrelevant. So basically, this notion of relevance in the case of Hilbert lattices is just about being included in some other subspace. No, all subspaces are relevant, others are irrelevant. So what we're going to do, though, is a completely reverse situation. We're going to use this notion and try to reconstruct Hilbert lattices. So this is non-trivial if we want to use this property to reconstruct what in Hilbert lattices is assumed is trivial.
This is why X
Yes, I think so. Well, no, because if okay, to find out if X is irrelevant with respect to Y orthogonal complement to the orthogonal complement of Y, you just look at that, right? If you look at that, you find that X double complement means the same element, right? So Y orthogonally complemented this is Y, this thing, right? And X meet Y, in this case, if X is not zero, so this thing is not zero, so it's irrelevant.
It's probably clear that
No, it means irrelevance here means that if you ask a question after another, you have to forget what you have learned. Right? That's what it means. So if you ask Y perp in particular, and if you ask X after that, you basically have to forget what you have learned here. That's the thing. Well, imagine in a Hilbert space it's quite easy. In a Hilbert space, you're talking about subspaces. So you can have a measure along X along the Z axis, right? And then you can have a measure in the plane ZY. Right? And these are going to be subspaces. So that's going to preserve relevance. Right? If you look at ZY, at the plane ZY, its perpendicular is going to be the X axis. Right? So Z axis and X axis, one of these is going to be irrelevant with respect to other. That means that if you measure along X and then you measure along Z, you forget what your concrete result was along X, because you know you get uncertainty along X, right? So that's what it means. Yeah. In a Hilbert space.
So from the definition, for example, A perp is irrelevant with respect to A.
From the definition. Yeah, that means if you
seem quite right to say if I measure A perp, I get what I knew about A.
That's debatable. Let's come back to this at the end, because exactly, well, that touches on one of the problems I want to talk about later. Okay, so this is just to end this part. There are examples when what is true in the Hilbert space is not true in a general lattice. So this thing is not a trivial notion, of course. So there are lattices which are orthocomplemented and where it doesn't work the way it works in the Hilbert lattices. Okay, so some assumptions about this notion before I show the lemma that that proves the result. There are two assumptions. The first assumption is that the notion of relevance, if it is preserved, then the amount of information grows monotonously. That means if nothing becomes irrelevant and if we obtain new information, then we get more information. The amount of information has grown. And the second assumption, again, is about the lattice. This is one of those typical assumptions in quantum logic that all possible questions are in my lattice. So my lattice is a sort of complete with respect to all kinds of questions I can ask. This is the same thing for Piron or for any other quantum logical derivation. So with these two assumptions, The way proof of orthomodularity works is that we consider, maybe I'll go a bit quicker on the proof. We consider a certain sequence of questions which, if everything is relevant, actually goes beyond the allowed upper limit of relevant information. So remember axiom one told us that there is an upper limit of relevant information, which we call N. Then we select some question. We select a sequence because there are any questions in the lattice. We select another question from the so that it brings about N bits of information. And then we... I'm sorry, could you get... Oh, one question doesn't give it. Questions can bring you. You don't know how many bits of information questions bring you because. No, but the question also is how much you have to forget with the previous question from your previous memory. You know, you have this relevant information. You ask a question, you get a yes or no. Right, but this means maybe you have to forget, you know, and by two or previous bits, or maybe you don't have to forget anything. Yes. All of these are yes or no questions,
so,
except that.
So A is a yes or no question. A closes a yes or no question, and you're saying that N is different from asking two questions.
No, I'm saying what you have here is that in the lattice, I'm saying you're in some state, right? So that A tilde brings you to the situation where you have N bits of relevant information, right? Okay. So the proofs are here. The mathematical proofs which we need, which I don't have here in all of the detail, are here. So we have to prove this result. That's what I'm doing in the paper. And then we show from there that there is a question B such that if B were relevant with respect to A and A tilde, then asking these three questions in the same situation would bring about more information because relevance would be completely preserved. And so if this could bring us more information than this sequence, then it would be more than n bits of relevant information. So that contradicts the axiom.
Sorry, that first one, do you mean n bits of relevant information or n bits of information?
N bits of relevant information. Yeah, this is a shortcut language. It's about relevant information. So this phrase fully reads, brings us to a situation when we have n bits of relevant information. Okay, so this is how from axiom one we want to motivate orthomodularity of the lattice. So the remainder of this talk is going to be about what else must be added to get quantum mechanics and what kind of problems we see on the way. From the orthomodular lattice to the Hilbert space, the way is not that simple. We still need an assumption here about some number field on which we're going to build a space. So what is happening here is that we're considering a vector space over some concrete number field. And then we are showing that our lattice is isomorphic to the lattice of closed subspaces of that space. So there is a non-operational step here. We have some space with some number field, which comes from nowhere. And we are showing that this lattice is isomorphic to the lattice of closed subspaces of that space. So then we're building an inner product on that space so that it becomes a Hilbert space. That's the way how one reconstructs the Hilbert space. Now, this theorem, of course, is based on the results from quantum logic, which exist, which have existed for the last 25 years or so. Here's a version of the general result which I'm using mathematically here. Once you have an orthomodal lattice, to get to the Hilbert space. One can also use different versions. So this is a version by Gudrun Kalmbach from the early 80s. One can use, let's say, Piron's original ideas. It's a different version. It doesn't come with the same assumptions. You know, it has to have something about atomicity and the way atoms work. And this doesn't, for example, this doesn't speak about atoms, right? So it's mostly a reformulation, if you like. But the sets of assumptions are not literally the same. They're every time slightly different. So I'm using this because I like it. It allows me actually to see the problems. And the problem I'm going to talk about here is the number field. Right, rather than all these things. So I'm not going to talk about these things. So all this, remember, is about the Hilbert space. So we're not yet going into state space, time evolution, things like this, right? So this is about the state of the Hilbert space. Let me spend 5 minutes. How much time do I have left? Maybe 20. 25 past? Okay, we'll try. Let me spend 5 minutes going through this pretty quickly. So this is going to be about the continuity assumptions. You have just seen that something must be said about the number field on which this vector space lives. The number field, real complex numbers or quaternions, can be postulated by postulate, right? Or can be motivated by some other assumptions. So this is the first kind of continuity assumptions I want to talk about here. And you will see why these are continuity assumptions. And there will be a second kind of continuity assumptions, very much related. So this is a simple way to do it. You postulate it. There are complicated ways to get your number field. Mostly the most famous way is Soler's theorem. And then there are some other results by other people. So here's an example. There is some axiomatic system which you don't have to read all the, through the details. I'm not going to explain. But look here, there's some non-constant function from the real interval to some piece of, let's say, what can be thought as a piece of my lattice. So in every axiomatic system of this kind, there are assumptions about some function from, you know, real interval or some continuous structure. And there is one exception, as you know very well. There is one exception to this sort of axiomatic systems, which is Soler's theorem. Soler's theorem gives an algebraic argument, which leads us to a topological result. So the topological result being the number field. The argument is algebraic, and at the same time, it involves infinities, so it gives us infinite dimensional Hilbert space only, right? There's no argument for finite dimensional Hilbert spaces other than this infinite dimensional space. So the theorem by Marie-Pierre Soler works like this. There should be an infinite orthonormal sequence. That means a sequence of vectors which are all orthogonal to each other and of norm 1. And there should be a vector space with an orthomodular form. So you remember we had an argument for orthomodularity. And now we have to add this infinite orthonormal sequence here. And then the field becomes real complex numbers or quaternions. So this is the only available algebraic result, which leads us to the correct number field. This was proven, I think, in the early 90s, but was really, or late 80s. 95, which was really popularized by S.S. Holland. So Soler is a strange person who disappeared in Nature. There is an important paper by S.S. Holland, which really brought this result into consideration of the community. Well, she left the field, and we actually people know where she is now, but she's not working. She's not working on physics or logic or anything. Yeah, she's doing some. No, that's the French expression, disparaître dans la nature. Right. Okay. Okay. So there are further ingredients. Okay. Let me list the ingredients, just for us to have a complete list of what we have to reconstruct. Right. So this first thing was the Hilbert space. Now, quantum classical theory can live in a Hilbert space, as we know. So we have actually to have some argument for the quantumness of our theory. This argument right here, and I really don't want to spend time, is based on axiom 2, but it is very problematic. So something has to be said about why the theory becomes quantum once you have a Hilbert space. Then something must be said about the state space and the Born rule. These are things which I discuss in my papers, and I want to go to another piece of work. So let me go very quickly. The usual way to derive the structure here for the state space and the Born rule is to assume that there is some function, some probability function, and to motivate the conditions that allow one to use Gleason's theorem. So in the information theoretic language, one can sort of translate Gleason's non-contextuality condition in different ways. This is my favorite formulation in the information theoretic language, which is basically to say that if you get some information, it comes without a context. That means there's no further information about how you were going around for obtaining your actual information. So there is no context into which information is brought about. So this is pretty vague, but this is to say that state space and the Born rule must still be obtained by further axioms, by further input. Right, and finally, okay, yeah, let me just add here a final ingredient before I go to those slides. So that final ingredient will be time evolution. I think I have a slide about it, but slightly later. So once we have all these things, we can say that quantum mechanics has been reconstructed. And all the things require special assumptions and further axioms. Let's look at the superposition principle, which is something we want to get at this stage when we're talking about states. Superposition principle, once again, and here I will mention Chaslov's work and what he has said just in the first talk here. There has to be some continuity assumption to get it. There is a bunch of different options. Ravelli tries, but there's really no result here, to obtain superposition principle from the consistency between these descriptions by different observers. There is work by Chaslov and Anton Zeilinger, who are talking about continuous changes between mutually complementary propositions. And there is always an assumption of continuity. There's work by S.S. Holland, who's again talking about some continuity assumption, which is an ample unitary group assumption in his axiomatic system. So this is axiom D in Holland. Then there is another axiomatic system by Lanzmann in the Netherlands, who is again making a continuity postulate when he says that certain algebraic structure is required to be isomorphic to a sphere. So these continuity assumptions, whenever we talk about the superposition principle, are unavoidable. Again, that's something which you see in every reconstruction, and that's an open problem. What can we do something to avoid the continuity assumption made directly? Can we operationally motivate it? Can we informationally motivate it? Can we simply say that, no, that's a Platonic assumption from the Platonic world that we have to live with to reconstruct quantum mechanics, and there is no way around it? So that's an open question to be debated, I think. Well, the Lucene, of course, with his continuity assumption, we have already talked about it today. So time and unitary dynamics, this is something I've already mentioned. So the open problems, just to give you a quick list here, in these quantum logical reconstructions, are the problems related to the meaning of the lattice structure, which we have discussed a little bit, but these are, is there an operational meaning of the lattice structure, meaning of the numeric field, what kind of assumptions do we need for that? Interpretation of probability, can we use Gleason theorem? How do we motivate non-contextuality, or what else can we do? Origins of assumption concerning time evolution, this is stage four here. Then there are other problems, dimension of the Hilbert space, which in quantum logic you don't see how you can reconstruct. When I said you postulate a vector space whose lattice is going to be isomorphic to your orthomodule lattice, you don't really know how to get that vector space operationally, what kind of dimension you have to select for it. So some other arguments, maybe from symmetry, must be used here. And finally, the question of superselection rules, which is another open topic. So that's a quick list. There are further topics there. Of course, there is a big issue of compositionality. How do you put two things together, two systems together? So the problem of subsystems in the quantum logical framework, I believe that it has no solution in the quantum logical framework. We actually have to go elsewhere. So these are the open questions, which I think during this conference we'll be debating more or less after every talk. Let me finish in the remaining 3 minutes by one remark, which is really not a result, but a remark about the role of observer and what we mean by observer in the information theoretic derivations. So many of the derivations start with something like this quote from Rovelli, which says all systems are equivalent. Remember, we have this fundamental notion of a system. Well, we don't care what that system is physically. We just call it a system. Any system can be an observer. Any system can have information about any other system. So there is nothing in the theory that really tells us why certain systems can have information about other systems and certain cannot. Every system, this is for Rovelli, this is really a hypothesis, which he is using all the time in his work. All systems are equal as far as being an observer, being observing is concerned. So every system is a legitimate observer. Now, is that a reasonable assumption? On one hand, of course, we have our everyday experience, and we know from the Copenhagen work that this is far from reasonable. On the other hand, we want to sort of abstract from those Copenhagen arguments and still try to set up the most general framework possible in which, as Rovelli would like to have it, any system could be an observer. Is there an argument which says that we can't go that far from Copenhagen? How far can we go from Copenhagen? What can be an observer? What cannot be an observer? And here I think an interesting argument could be made based on the Landauer principle and on the erasure of information. Remember, I just spoke about this notion of relevance, which implies that you are forgetting some information that becomes irrelevant. This forgetting or becoming irrelevant is the same as for Landauer, who of course was not in the operational, in the information theoretic derivations program at all, right? But this forgetting or irrelevance is very much similar to the notion of erasure of information by the observer. Imagine an observer has a sort of memory register where he registers or she registers bits. So if we define observer in the most general way as a system capable of obtaining and erasing information, obtaining information is what we usually do in information theoretic frameworks, right? We also want to be able to erase information. So if we do that, then there is this argument to be had, which of course is only intuitive, but let's go through it and see what kind of limit it puts on the notion of observer. So there is this work by Jos Ufink and I think his collaborator or advisor at the time in the 80s, where they were talking about entropy associated with mutually complementary observables in quantum mechanics, with measuring one and then another one. So there is a bound on the accuracy with which the values of non-commutative observables can be simultaneously prepared. When we prepare the system in a state characterized by position and momentum, say, this is one of the things they studied in the 80s, the preparation must obey this formula. So there is some bound, some lower bound on the sum of these entropies. So when we prepare a quantum system, there is a minimal number of bits that we must erase from memory. Let's say if we have measured a position, and we want to prepare a system in a momentum eigenstate. So we need to forget something. The minimal number of bits to erase can be evaluated according to the Ufink-Mawson procedure, and happens to be 3. So this formula, again, when I said the argument is intuitive, this argument, I have checked mathematics in one of, I think, in one of the cases, but we have to, this must be, again, done in a clean way, if it's really always this number and not some other number. It's clear that there is a lower limit. I'm wondering, actually, listening to Chaslov's talk, I wonder whether this number 3 has anything to do with your number 3. I guess not, but who knows.
The problem is that the greatest power is the 1 in the first paragraph.
Yes, h bar is. When you translate it to spins, that's what I said. You have to look at the concrete arithmetic a little better. But as much as you get, you know, there might be some factor forgotten here. But at least for x and p, that's what you get for x and for position and momentum. I think I was able to see that. The same argument holds that h bars actually disappear from the formula, but this has to be looked at again. So, now this is really a sort of an information entropy associated with this erasure of memory. So this is what you do when you have some information about position and you want to measure a complementary observable. So this entropy is about the erasure of information. And then it would suggest that actually erasure of information involves generating heat, involves a minimal entropy. So the observer has to generate heat every time he asks a new question and forgets some information becoming irrelevant. So then it would mean that actually positions like Crivelli's are not tenable. And you cannot argue consistently that in information theoretic framework all observers can be treated on equal grounds. All systems can be equally well observers or observed systems. So this is something I would certainly, I shall certainly think more about. But if you have any remarks, I'd be happy to talk about these things. Can we use information theoretic arguments from entropy to better understand the notion of observer in information theoretic derivations? This is, I think, an open topic. Thank you.
We have half an hour for discussion. Chris.
Just on the last closing comment, I think there's something fishy about your argument linking the becoming irrelevant sort of information to actual erasure processes. So why might something change from being information to no longer being information? Well, because the facts change. So I might get some results. So I know that the system now spin up in the direction the same. So I might say, that's something I know. That's the value. I know the value of that observable. Now, there's some other measurements. I've changed the state of the system. So it's no longer the case that I know anything about those places on the Newton bar. No longer the case that I know anything about the original spin constant. But that's not because I've forgotten anything. It's because, you know, I remember what I did. I remember what the outcome was. So that bit in my memory is still always where the level was. It's no longer that the world is linked up in the right way as what I'm thinking.
But you've already done something. You've prepared. You've prepared the system for a new measurement, right? You've prepared a new measurement. So that seems. Yeah, but that seems to be like a meta-theoretical operation, which we, you know, this preparation operation, which we dismiss as just a meta-theoretical thing. You know, we can prepare systems as we like. But the question, so this argument is exactly about this. As you said, I know something. I know it's spin up, and then I. Learn something else in my new measurement. So of course, my new preparation, my new measurement, physically can be realized in a million different ways. But what Landauer, what the Landauer principle says, is that whatever the physical realization, the price of you learning this new thing is at least this number of bits. In any physical realization, whatever your efficiency, you're going to lose some bits.
Maybe another way to think of it is your brain will fill up and it's very little information on that. You don't have to erase something that's going to be across. So, is it like the computer erases the hard drive? It doesn't actually write over the disk. It just says this memory is now free, and then sometimes in the future it will get overwritten. This is a finite system. And because it's already the thermodynamic, we're seeing the
yeah, I guess you can say it's like that. Yeah. 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 Yeah, and there is an entropy associated with that because eventually, maybe, you know, eventually you'll come up and erase it physically if you like, but there is an entropy just because you mark it as non-information. Something which used to be information stopped being information.
But I guess you don't actually have to pay it. Yeah, you don't have to pay that actual running data cost. Just, I mean, the accounting says once I've marked this as free memory, then I have to pay for that to be erased. So I'm just going to mark it as free and say that is made or will be made.
Yeah, so you don't really know how these 3 bits or whatever bits of information really are dissipated into heat. You know, you don't know if you do it with a rubber now or if it happens later or something. You know that whichever the process is operational, it's going to cost at least this number of bits, and you don't care about the physical process. So that's why I'm saying the observer is a system capable of obtaining and erasing information, and you don't care about the physical content of what it means to obtain or to erase.
But I think the objection here, and I think it's valid, it's not as valid as I had the same one, which was, you know, you can go a long time just by writing down crap on a piece of paper, and you don't have to recycle it. But eventually you will if you have a finite memory. That's always these arguments, right? So there's got to be some time scale then over which you don't have to pay the erasure cost. And you can just keep writing on new pieces of paper, if you will. And then eventually you have to pay that. How would that fit?
Well, with this notion of relevance, for me here really I'm thinking about the notion of relevance in the sense that you can write these things, but these things you can write these things down on a piece of paper, but when you keep asking questions, there is, so the physics of the system, the physical description of the system is going to be such that some of the things you've written down on your piece of paper are going to be rubbish.
I understand that. What I'm saying is that if you have things in paper, you never need to erase them. But no system has infinite paper, which is the point. Because the Landauer erasure process is eventually it's going to have to erase something. So But nevertheless, when you actually have to erase it, is that related to how big it is?
And it's also related, let's say, if we're talking about a physical, about a series of physical experiments, it's also related to, you know, how you record the data, how you obtain that data, and things like this. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I just want to point that out because I don't think it's relevant. It's another parameter that you now have. I mean, the size of the system not only determines how much it can store, but it determines that along with the rate at which you're acquiring new multi-relevant information, plus the size of your system, gives you some sort of time scale on which you can operate without erasing. I don't know if it matters.
This information you don't need to erase because once the information becomes irrelevant, what happens to you guys is rubbish anyway. So the rating just needs change that bit to some random thing. Whatever symbol is written down in paper one help you predict any outcome of your returns you can make. So
But remember the Landauer principle doesn't speak about physical erasure. It's more about if you want, you can also speak about resetting instead of erasure, right? So
you have to reset, but actually physically move modules into a neutral state so that now you can write new information onto it. And that resetting process, I believe this is how it works, right? The resetting process is what actually takes.
Yes.
So you can say, oh, look, this is irrelevant, I don't need it. But if you want to write down something on a piece of paper, you better have either extra space on that paper, or if you fill up every space that there is, you better get rid of some of the ink so that you have new space to write. And it's that getting rid of the ink.
Yeah, but this debate is really a debate about the Landauer principle. Right? I mean, it's a debatable principle as such, too, of course. There are people who disagree. Open questions? Oh, the list of axioms? Right, here? Yes. Yeah, I think the first two axioms are something which is really insightful. So the first two are Avelli's axioms. And I believe that this is something which is really going to stay there about quantum theory. I mean, the interplay between this limit on relevant information and the possibility to acquire new information is something that has a message, conveys a message about quantum theory. But of course, to be technical about it and to see how that really works, you need all these other things. So this axiom 3 is about stage 3 here. The state space and the Born rule, provided that axiom 2 is about quantumness, but that's something that needs to be shown. And then there is a bunch of supplementary assumptions about the lattice and the number field, and then still there is an open issue of time. So it's on one hand, it's I believe that the first two axioms give us an important insight on how you build information theoretic reconstructions, and on the other hand, it's clear that this comes with a long list of supplementary assumptions that you need. Well, this is really about the lattice structure, and that's why I said my old strategy was to look at the lattices. I'm disenchanted about lattices. I don't like orthodox quantum logic with lattices as a framework. Maybe we should do something else. I don't know. So the same principles. I would love to be able to translate them, say, there's an easy translation in the information theoretic language of C-star algebras, but then, of course, you already have Hilbert spaces there, because once you have a C-star algebra. So maybe convex sets, maybe something else, you know. Then, of course, all these axioms here about lattices aren't needed anymore, and this axiom about the number field depends on what framework you're going to work with. So these things are really about mathematical frameworks.
Yeah, so that's what I was. So I think three first models are assumed to be a theorem. So the way it goes is that rather than thinking of distinct questions, like the abstract questions that we ask, you think of them as experimental operational experimental procedures. And then you make a physical assumption that with certainty of the yes outcome in the experimental procedure corresponds an ontological entity like an element of reality in sort of Einstein's sense. If you make that assumption, then you can actually prove that you have a lattice that has to be neat complete, which implies that it's a method. So first you get neat completeness, then you get the joints for free, you get that for free. And actually, then in the late work, which you know, did like in 1995, they derived the linearity of the evolution. You can also derive elements of the dense structure from. You can actually derive partly of quantum modularity from that sort of ontological assumption. You have to base this.
Ontological assumption, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah. Yeah, so I didn't know about this late work by Piron, but the ontological assumption, I had a feeling that this had to be there, and this is something really I don't like because I don't like ontology about quantum theory, but yeah.
The
yeah. Yeah. And the problem with that, yeah. So my problem with that is that it's a sort of property realism, you know, what they call in philosophy of physics. Yeah. So for me it's very, you know, it can be criticized quite severely. But of course, I agree that Piron can. Oh no, there is no talk of plurality. It's just element. You have a system which is really with this property. It lives with this property. Yeah. So then, whenever you say my system is like a quantum particle in space-time, Hoppian, you have a problem with local realism. But you don't have to say that. Your system here is just an algebraic thing. You know, it's just a logical system. But nobody says it's in space-time. Okay.
And that's all the details of the perspective
I have. Okay, question.
I'm afraid I don't really understand the axiom number three.
Yeah, that's a. I didn't really explain it, that's why.
Further information about the pressure spring about the information.
Yeah. Well, that really means that I want to have something which can be interpreted as Gleason's non-contextuality. So remember, this thing was devised so as we can use Gleason's theorem to derive a state space. So that means we want something which is going to resemble non-contextuality. So that means for Gleason, you know, for Gleason, the way Gleason works, Gleason theorem works, is that if there is an operator which belongs to, you know, one family, or if it belongs to another family, and if you measure this thing, it's not going to depend on the family to which this object. So this is a complete family, sums up to one, you know, things like this. So this is non-contextuality in Gleason's sense. The way this is really an attempt to interpret it information theoretically in the sense, in the following sense: if you have some information obtained from this thing, call it I, then there is no further information about, you know, how this I came about, whether it belonged to these things or those things. So there is no information J about any possible contexts. What you have is your information I, You don't have knowledge of, you know, the knowledge of some other settings or other things that could have come about. It's just I, nothing else. So this is a pretty much going the other way around. I mean, saying I want Gleason's theorem, so how can I formulate it information theoretically? So this is really not as serious as a derivation from the first two axioms. So this is sort of handpicked so that for stage three we have the Gleason theorem available.
Okay.
Right?
So
you see?
The information I is a list of questions and their answers.
No, information I is a question you ask.
So you're saying
yeah, so you asked a question, got an answer. You know which question you asked and which answer you got.
So let's have a few questions and out of
it's one, yeah. It's one question and one answer. It's one question you asked, one answer you got. And it says, if you ask one question, you get one answer. You don't get 10 other bits telling you about which context, which was the context when you got that bit. Yeah. You know, I have in those papers I've listed in my papers. I'm looking at a bunch of different papers from the 1960s. It's not just Schwinger. I don't think I'm really discussing Schwinger, but what you usually have in those papers, of course, when I showed Mackie here, I was kind of radical, saying, you know, this is just mathematics. But of course, if you read Mackie attentively, he's trying to make sense of certain things. Where's Mackie? Okay, sorry. Here's Mackie. Right. Okay. So of course, if you read this, if you read his text, he's also trying to make sense of these are axioms, and he's trying to motivate certain things. But he's just for me, and Schwinger too, and most people working in the 60s did that. You know, even Ludwig, with his pure mathematics, actually has chapters where he's trying to explain things. What is different for me in the work of the last 15 years, let's say, is that people really start with these principles which don't come to them from mathematics or frameworks. Now, people start with principles that they see from their practice of quantum theory and statements which they believe to be fundamentally true. And then, so principles come first again, and then mathematical frameworks and things. So maybe Schwinger was already partly in this direction. I should go and check the articles, but the difference between the 60s and the 90s and the last 10 years is really for me how people think about this. What is first, what is second? You don't start with mathematics and then try to explain it.
Maximum amount of information,
relevant information,
which seems to refer to finite dimensional systems. But in the middle of the derivation, at one point, we had this infinite sequence of orthonormal vectors,
That was not my derivation, right? So what we had there, my derivation really is an excellent. I was talking about the alternatives to the assumption of continuity, of the assumption of the numeric field instead of axiomatic assumptions. So here is this detail. Here we go. So for me, for my derivation, it's an assumption, right? It's an axiom. You can substitute it with other motivations. So this goes, okay, this is a sort of diversion from my main line of the derivation, where I say, here are some alternatives. These alternatives work in a different framework. I mean, Soler speaks about different things.
This actually brings me to my second question of detail, which is, I remember we had a lattice at the start, and then there was an argument that made it into an orthogonal modular lattice.
Yes.
So at what point did it become the subspaces of a vector space?
Yeah, that's what I said. When we have the theorem, so we take from nowhere. That's a problematic point. We take from nowhere a vector space.
Does that theorem assume that it's the subspaces?
We take a vector space with its lattice of closed subspaces, and we show that our lattice is isomorphic to that one. Where does this vector space with its lattice of closed subspaces come from? We ignore it. That's a problem in this. So here's a vector space with the lattice of its closed subspaces. And we just show that it's isomorphic to our lattice. But how you construct this, we have no idea. I can't
guarantee that there is some
It's an extra assumption. There is a vector space. What is guaranteed is that once you have a vector space, you're going to have a Hilbert space. But the fact that you have a vector space is an assumption.
Can I ask my general question then? You had a quote from Rovelli near the beginning.
Yes.
Not understanding quantum theory until we had it right from, and I think it was physical principles or physical postulates.
Simple physical principles, postulates, and records.
It's the sort of thing you have in mind. None of our postulates are what I would think of as physical.
Well, he clearly had in mind, because it's from the same article, that these axioms 1 and 2 offer him simple physical assertions. And what I mean here is, again, postulates which are experimentally motivated. That means these are true statements, as Shostov said, or Lucin said, these are true statements about our practice of quantum mechanics when we just do ordinary quantum mechanics as physicists. And then we elevate these things. There's this whole debate about the notion of elevation of something into a principle, which goes back to Einstein, because this is the notion Einstein uses for special relativity and then general relativity back in the 19, there's a lot of work by Michael Friedman about this notion of elevating something into a principle. So it starts in 1907, I think, something like this. So that's really, for me, what is happening here. We take some assertions about our practice of quantum theory, we elevate them to principles or postulates, and we see if we can derive it. That's what Einstein did with special relativity.
There's certainly principles. My quibble is really whether they're physical principles.
They're physical in the sense, if you want, they're physical in the sense that we take them from our practice of physics. So they will, yeah. But of course, the language in which we formulate them here is information theoretic language, which is, you know, is it physical? That's a big question. In the same way as for Einstein, the notion of simultaneity, for example, which was not a physical notion before, became a physical notion. So it became it was elevated into a fundamental notion. Yeah, well, it's Wigner's and Stone's theorem in this, in my approach, but of course, So what we need here is to assume that there are, so we assume there are time moments, there's a T1, T2, etc. Assume that relevance commutes with this. And then what we want is to use Wigner's theorem. So that's one way to do it. But I'm sure there may be other ways. This is just, you know, the way I use to motivate time evolution. Yeah. But again, it assumes that, as in the question that was asked, it assumes that there are T1, T2, etc. So there are some time moments, right? And then what you, so it doesn't reconstruct time as such. And that's that's another big problem of, you know, how you bring time into this kind of frameworks. And in the algebraic frameworks, that you have much more to say than in quantum logical frameworks about this, of course. You know, in Feynman algebras, you can say more.
Yeah, but just somewhat what they do actually in this work, so again, from this ontology, you can actually show that all these questions have to propagate the perturbation of the joint, and then you use the representation theorem of the projective geometry again, together with the Wigner's theorem,
right,
and reconstruct.
So yeah, that's interesting. That's more or less, because what I need here is that all these questions propagate with the preservation of relevance. So that's the same philosophy, I think, more or less.
It does require quite a philosophy to match essentially very recent, so 99,000 okay. Far and early, where they sort of extend, they do some categorical extension of the basic theorems of the basic theorem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's sort of more general. Because if they just need a preservation of join, because I need something which, of course, is more expensive. I need a preservation of some relevance notion. If preservation of join sounds like pretty cheap to get time evolution. Yeah. So there's is this mentioned in this paper used in the studies?
95 things.
Yeah, I should ask you about it. Yeah. You can, but you have it right. Yeah, I'll send you an email. Yeah.
Okay, any more? It's almost 4 o'clock, so let's break for a couple. Thank you.
Thank you.